And Dr. Huffman, I wonder if we could start. I'll just give some basic biographical information. I'm Paul Ortiz, director of the Samuel Proctor Oral History Program. I'm interviewing Dr. Huffman this afternoon. Dr. Huffman, thank you so much for taking time out of your very busy schedule to interview.
Thank you.
And Dr. Huffman, I understand that today you want to talk primarily about your experiences in World War II. Is that correct?
Yes.
So how did you end up getting involved in World War II?
Well, I went to Virginia Tech in 1937 or 36, I guess, and then but graduated in 41 mm-hmm. in June, 6 months before Pearl Harbor. And when I got my BS degree in conservation and forestry, I also got my second lieutenant's commission. And then I was sent to Fort Monroe, Virginia to get my physical, and I was physically qualified, and that's when I was sworn in. Mm-hmm. That was June 21st, 1941, 6 months before Pearl Harbor.
Okay.
And my first assignment was at Fort Monroe, Virginia, and I was sent to a refresher course in Coast Artillery. I was in the Coast Artillery Corps.
Okay.
You know, land guns shooting at the Navy's coming in, you know. Mm-hmm. I usually start off by saying that, you know, when we think of World War II veterans, the ones that we really honor are those who were wounded or were killed and or went through the front lines. But there were just thousands and thousands, probably a ratio of 30 to 1, of people in the background supporting the troops, and I was one of those.
Okay.
However, from time to time, those people would pass in harm's way. Mm-hmm. And my frightening times when I was an officer on board a ship going to the Pacific, and the officers had to go down and stay with the men during submarine scares. Uh-huh. Now, in those crowded rooms down, quarters down below, it was scary.
Okay.
When they were, and the other time when I was doing a little reconnoitering work on the island Peleliu, I became 4 inches of stepping on a landmine. Mm. I stepped across the log and my foot was going down and I saw the land, my personnel mine. Uh-huh. So that was the clearest of ever. But the first night I was in Peleliu, I had bullets flying in through the area from snipers up the way. Okay. And the day I landed, we were so close, and I'll tell you about this later.
Okay.
We were so close in our ship before we unloaded, going back and forth and unloading our ship. And the fighting was going on just a half a mile away. And we could see them, and the flies were getting on our fruit. I got sick. I was supposed to land on Peleliu D plus 5 to 30, but I actually landed D plus 40 because I was ill. I was in the sick bay on the ship. But anyway, I was on the island command of Peleliu, but I'm getting ahead of myself. But I say that when we think about World War III, we're mainly talking about the veterans who died or were wounded or things like that up in the front lines. Well, I didn't have that serious, you know, and I never fired my gun. I carried my gun, but I never fired it.
Well, it reminds me of something that General Pershing said in World War I. At the end of the war, he was interviewed, and he said, this war was won by supply and service.
Right.
He said, from here on out, modern warfare, this is what it's all about, is supply and service.
Yes. Well, my first assignment was at Fort Monroe, Virginia, and we studied the tactics and the operations of a coast artillery forces. Mm-hmm. But what I learned there at that first school, I made use of when I was writing the defenses of the Southern Palaus. And I got a commendation for doing that because I was well educated in tactics and so forth about Coast Artillery. So I was an ideal person to write the Southern, when we took the island, mm-hmm. we had to write the defense of that area. And I want to show you, if we'll take a short break.
Okay.
We'll walk over and see those maps.
Okay.
And let's just do that, just a second. Okay. We'll come back here in just a sec.
Well, I can actually bring the recorder over there because it has a battery. If you want to describe the maps.
Now, I'm getting ahead of myself, but these are the actual maps we used.
Okay.
Now, there's Peleliu, and here's Babblethorpe. There were 60,000 Japs there. And over here is a smaller map, and even a smaller one here. And so these are the actual maps that I used on in Allen Command to do my operations.
Okay.
Here I got aerial photographs of pictures that were given to me by a flyer who took these maps. And here's the airfield, and this is where almost a whole regiment of Marines were killed. Only 17 men survived out of that regiment. Right there. Bloody Nose Ridge. That's the bad part. Hundreds. There were 12,000 Japs. 10 to 12,000 Japs in those, in this ridge there in the island. So that, I just wanted to show you the maps at Peleliu before we got started.
Okay.
Now we won't have to come back over there. But I was taken in, went to that school, and following 10 weeks of training, I was sent to Fort Eustis. And this is an outline of this is my family. And these are maps showing where I was born and where Fort Eustis and Fort Monroe. Fort Eustis is located right above Newport News. One day our whole battalion walked to Yorktown, so we're 17 miles from Yorktown, so okay. That's where Eustis is. Now, at Eustis, I was a platoon officer, and so I had 35 or 40 men under me, and I went through two 10-week sessions there, and when you teach a subject, you really learn it. So when I was giving different assignments, chemical warfare, transportation, a supply officer, you take different jobs time to time. So you get a wonderful education when you're in a training situation.
Yeah.
And but after about a year and a half, about 14 months after Eustis, I was shipped out. But one event happened. One time, the troops that I was platoon leader, they were going to be shipped out the next day. And so this day, I didn't have anything to do. They didn't have anything on their schedule. So I took them down by the James River on a hike. And we had a great time. They were young, I was young, and I was enthusiastic. We had a great time. I got back about 11 o'clock. And the first sergeant said, "Lieutenant, didn't you have an appointment at 10 o'clock this morning?" And no. I had stood up 1,000 men in the post theater. I was supposed to give a talk.
Oh, no.
I was signed orientation officers, and I was supposed to give a talk of why we fight.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't show up. Well, I had to go to the battalion, a battery commander, to the battalion commander, and group commander, and all of them were very kind.
Uh-huh.
But on the way back to my headquarters in my battery area, I stopped by the battalions whose group I stood up.
Uh-huh.
Boy, he stood me at attention and gave me a blasting that I deserved, you know. Well, anyway, a month later, I was promoted. I was taken up to the headquarters as an adjutant and personnel officer. And that was the first step that I went into staff work. And one time we had a parade, and I was the battalion adjutant. And I'd never done it before, but you learn your ropes, you know, what you're supposed to do. And so I'm the one that gets out in the middle fields, give the orders of the day and the orders of the guard. And then if the officers have to meet, come forward, you give the order officers front and center and march. And that's when the band starts playing, they pass in review, or at least the officers come front or pass in review, depending on what the order is. So I did that for the first time. Well, then we had a troop that we were changed to from 8th Battalion, Training Battalion, to the 101st Training Battalion, and 4,000 troops were shipped to California on Monterey Bay. Mm-hmm. And I was there for about a year. And at first, I was an adjutant. And after the first parade, the adjutant, the real field adjutant, was about 45, and he was bay window, and he, when he went out there, he had to read everything, and you couldn't hear what he said. And one of my friends said, you ought to get Jay Kaufman to do that. And so the next parade, they asked me to be the field for the parade adjutant, and for the next year, I was the adjutant at every parade.
Wow.
So I had a lot of fun doing that. And I have a picture of me doing that. I'll show you in a minute. But as soon as I, shortly after I was there, I had left a girl in Fredericksburg. In 1938, the summer, I was a Japanese beetle inspector. I met these young people, including this girl. She came to VPI and pinned on my ring. For the next 6 years, she was my girlfriend. But it was mostly an airmail romance, you know. And but anyway, I wanted to see her. And so I put in for camouflage school back at Fort Belvoir. And so I went to Fort Belvoir and spent about 2 or 3 weeks learning about camouflage. Had to leave, and I saw my girl, went back to California. Well, when I got back out there, they took me up into the headquarters as a training officer, and I was in charge of demonstration areas, including camouflage. And I did field fortification and camouflaged everything in sight, and including we had 2.155 millimeter guns on the coast, and I camouflaged those. And then I wanted to see them, so I went to the blimp station and asked if they could take me up and let me take photographs of my work, which I did. And I first flew in a Cub, and then I had 2 blimp rods, and those were wonderful. And then the last, it was not high altitude, so I went to the Army and went in the AT-6 as a passenger in one of the trainers, you know, for fighters. And the fellow came out high altitude, 10,000 feet. And going back, he said, would you like to do some acrobat? And he did barrel rolls and loop-the-loops and all that and power dives, and I just loved it. Anyway, those were the perks, you know, of having that job. Well, then I saw an opening for a Commander General Staff School in Leavenworth, Kansas, and I asked for it. I later saw that they had scratched somebody and put my name in. I think it was because of my request. And maybe my record, what I've done so far, and they asked me. It was a classroom of 700 officers, and mostly generals and colonels and majors. I was the young, most lowly ranked person in there. They were giving training us to be staff officers for armies and corps and engineers, army, corps, and divisions for the invasion of Europe. So we can study the invasion of Europe. Mm-hmm. Then they put me in an officer's pool back at Fort Monroe, and while waiting for assignment, well, I finally got orders to fly priority to the Pacific. I was assigned to the Navy, joint operations. So I flew the country, was in 4 days in San Francisco, saw my first opera, and at 2 a.m., the fourth day, took off on the Nats China Clipper. They had taken over the Pan American China Clippers. And I flew in the China Clippers over Golden Gate Bridge. It was all lit up. As soon as you passed it and looked back, it was dark as blazes, you know, not blazes. Anyway, it was very dark. And next morning we landed in Hawaii. And I was there for 19 days. And then I got on a brand new ship. And I was on that ship for 70 days. Mm. It was a brand new ship, 1/3 loaded on its maiden voyage. And it was headed towards Peleliu. But it took 70 days to get there. We stayed 30 days in Kwajalein Atoll for a while, just waiting time, you know. And finally, we got to the Palouse, and as I said, we were sailing just back and forth, and right next to the island, we were unloading, and we could see the planes. We had already captured the airfield, the Marines, and the planes would come around and back us and drop napalm. And I've got pictures of that. Let me see that little book there. I may have it in there. I've got lots of pictures, but I don't have time to. Oh boy! Oh, now this is when I went to Civil Affairs place. I don't see them here. These are the 1st Marine Division's taking the headquarters building, and here's where we were traveling back and forth, and Buddy Nose Ridge is here at the airport, and they were flying around here and dropping napalm on the Marines. And the Army took over after 30 days. And the Marines got on my ship that I went on over there after, but they got on. And boy, they were a rugged-looking group. I mean, messy and tired and worn out. You know, it was terrible. And this is the headquarters building that we finally captured. And the Admiral was the island commander. And there's the Joint Operations Center there. I'm showing you a picture.
Okay.
And this is the old building that the Japanese had. The walls were this thick, 3 feet thick. And there were blasted holes through it, but the Seabees fixed them up with tube of fours and canvas. But this was the island command. And my picture's here, right here. And that showed about 25, 30 officers.
Okay.
And then here's my tent on the other side of the building. Here's the same building, and here it is. But you see, this fella is holding up a machete. I have it here. I brought it back. This fella here and I had gone up the island to reconnoiter, and I found this brush hook that the Japanese had, and I brought that back. And that was in about November. We landed in August, I think, 15th. But in November, that was when we were reconnoitering. And then I found this brush hook. And that's when I almost stepped on a landmine.
Uh-huh.
But 60,000 Japs were up here at Babblethorpe, and you saw the big map where they were.
Yeah.
One night, I was on duty in November. I was in headquarters by myself with some enlisted men, and there were two unknown objects coming down. We didn't know what they were, and I sent up... Here's the Pan American Clipper. That's how I got there. Oh, here they are bombing. So this is just what I saw. And then one night, as I was on detail from 4 to 12, two unknown objects started coming down.
Uh-huh.
And this one disappeared in the rain, and this one was identified as one of our picket ships the Navy had out here.
Okay.
But at 2 o'clock, somebody shook me on the shoulder and said, Jake, get up. Japanese on the island.
Whoa.
And they came in here and they got hung up on the reefs, and these got hung up too. By 7 o'clock or daylight, a little after daylight, they were all killed.
Okay.
We only had one casualty that night.
They were Japanese ships?
Yeah, or they were just barges, and they came down with loincloths and homemade grenades and spears, and they were supposed to destroy airplanes and
like a suicide mission.
They were starving to death up there up north. These are just some of the newspapers and all that I had. And there's Babblethorpe, and here's Peleliu.
Okay.
And anyway, I was there. After a while, things sort of settled down. I should say one other thing. When I landed after D plus 40, we landed right here, and I got on a truck. I called headquarters, and they said to come on out to the headquarters.
Uh-huh.
While I was in a tent talking to somebody, when I came out, this enlisted man who had also been sick says, "We thought you were shot. There was a captain just shot here." So that their sniper had gotten somewhere right out there.
Shoot.
So, you know, they're swampy. So
yeah.
The Japanese would come on down. They would infiltrate down
people
and get in.
People could hide there. And
and this is on another ship. I mean, on another island that I'll eventually get to. But let me just go back to, that's the end of the whole thing. On Peleliu, we had 1st Marine Division. They left after 30 days, and the Army Regiment took over. And there were Japanese still in those hills a year later.
Wow.
And the last one came in 1967.
Are you serious?
Wow. That's what I saw in the newspaper.
Hmm.
We mostly had service troops around the island, you know. And my first job was to, and I had a boy, a boss was a full colonel, and he was Coast Artillery also, so he and I got along fine. And he helped me, or I helped him, write the fence of the Southern Palaus. And it included when something would happen, we got on a communication center with all the units.
Okay.
And that night, when I got, they woke me up and I went out, I got on and we followed our plan, and I got everybody on the phone, and then we gave them a message that the Japs were on the island. And so that everybody was informed by 4 o'clock, you know, that the Japs were close by. So that's how it worked. And, but anyway, eventually I got a commendation for writing those things. And then I was assigned to the island of Injibi back at in the Kowaljan Atoll. And I was named, here's the Kowaljan Atoll. It's way back in the middle of the Pacific. They'd taken it months earlier.
Uh-huh.
So it was a rear area. But there were a lot of islands around there that were full of Japanese. So I was employed on the staff of 125 naval officers and 2 Army. We were stationed on this little island off of the big island of Kowaljan. And my job was to fly to different islands in the Marshall Gilbert's area and check on the defenses, the aerial and local defenses, mostly service troops, against submarines and attacking bypassed Japanese. So I got a couple of maps here showing greater detail of those places. Maybe you can help me turn those pages.
Okay.
And the Admiral had bombed out a pool out of the coral, and so that's where he swam, and that's where the rest of us swam, went swimming, and I had a snorkel so I could look for tropical fish. And I did play tennis with the Admiral. He was a very lonesome man. He was isolated. I can't find where I am. I'm looking for those different islands you can turn the pages there. I can find them here.
Okay.
We are moving along rather fast. here's my job as staff officer, and I could have shown you all these pictures, but I'll come back to these pictures later on. Here's the marshal's area.
Okay.
And here I'd fly over to Eniwetok, Injibe, and here I flew in this torpedo bomber. I was in the bay
okay.
of that. I'd fly on anything as a passenger, you know, and then Roy and come on down. Then I went down to Majuro and back, and then I was also went up to this island up here. But it was excellent duty because I would go ashore, talk to the commander, look at his plans for defense, and then get in his jeep and ride around his island, and then have dinner with him, and then leave next day and go somewhere else. But while I was here, I also wrote the history. While I was sitting at my desk, I'd get all the dispatches each day, and I would write the strikes that the various planes would take on these local islands, you know, to neutralize them. So that was interesting to do that. So here's a marshal area. Then eventually, after doing that for only 4 months, oh, the war ended, then I flew to Hawaii, and I was on the commanding staff of the commanding general of the Pacific Ocean area. I'm going to go back and show you some of these pictures later on.
Okay.
So I went to Fort Shafter and Oahu, and where is it?
You took a lot of photographs. What kind of camera were you using?
Oh.
You were taking these pictures?
Oh, I just had a little, some of these were taken by other people and gave me.
Okay.
So I didn't, all these were not taken by me. So, but here's the headquarters, and I just happened to get to stand behind the commanding general. But I was writing, I was getting mail.
Uh-huh.
The command was getting mail, and so I was just, I think they sent me the certain letters, and I would use standing operating procedures and Army regulations, U.S. Army regulations, to answer the letters for their signature.
Uh-huh.
And if I did it right, well, they had never heard from them. But if I didn't do it right, they'd send it back and marked up, do this again, you know. And so I had a few of those, but I did pretty well. But that was a beautiful duty, good food. I was in a two officer in a little cottage on the golf course. I played a little bit of golf. I was on the bowling team. I played tennis. And so and that's when the war in Europe ended. And wives were beginning to come back. And I just decided, I was single. I decided I didn't want this life. Mm-hmm. You know, the Army life.
Yeah.
And so I went back, and after a few days at home, I was at Duke University getting my master's degree.
Okay.
In forestry and wood science. But the other thing, while I was in, and that general there in Hawaii, he had a very large, MacArthur had the Southwest Pacific, and this guy had the rest of the Pacific. So it was a big command, and the letters were wide-ranging in subject. But that was only 4 months. But I did get rest and recreation over on the big island of Hawaii.
Uh-huh.
And there was a cabin I stayed in, and there were...
people surfing.
Well, that's just I didn't do it.
Uh-huh.
But this was on the near Oahu, and I did take these pictures.
Oh, that's a beautiful waterfall.
And it's right outside of Oahu.
Oh, is that the... Okay, so that...
And now I'm just trying to show you one set of pictures here if I can find them. Oh, boy. Oh, this is... Oh, here's some of them, maybe. Oh, now this is the girl. I fell in love with her briefly. She was a Red Cross a nurse. But she came to visit me at Duke one weekend, and she just played the piano beautifully.
Uh-huh.
Just a lovely girl. But I wrote in my notes, I could never marry her because she was a Yankee. But she was a lovely girl.
Uh-huh.
And I do have a big picture of her somewhere here.
You know, it's interesting, Dr. Hoffman. My wife and I went to visit Pearl Harbor for the first time 2 years ago.
Uh-huh.
We went to see the Arizona.
Oh, yeah.
And we went to the monuments. And then I took her to the old base that we had set up in that gigantic volcanic crater that had those track guns.
Uh-huh.
Apparently, when the Japanese flew in Pearl Harbor, those guns, gigantic, enormous, fired at the planes. Now, of course, it was worthless because those guns were designed for coast defense. I mean, those guns would have sunk a ship in a heartbeat, but quite useless against planes.
No.
And what I'd heard was that actually the rounds that they fired actually, of course, missed the planes and landed on the city quite tragically.
A lot of friendly fire.
It was like a mismatch of technology. Yeah. Somehow we had gotten behind in terms of strategy.
Well, after going to this recreation camp, I had a few days there. And whenever you leave a camp, you have to sign out all the laundry, the Monster Club, and you have to get a lot of signatures. So I have those chits, you know, that I had to sign, and I kept those. I kept everything.
You saved everything.
And,
wow.
So I had, I guess I flew back to San Francisco. I met some old friends. And then got on a train and came across the country, went to
You went back to I see Fort Bragg.
Bragg, yeah. That's where I signed out.
I was stationed at Fort Bragg for 2 years.
Yeah, well, that's where I signed out. Then I got on a train and went to Roanoke, Virginia.
Uh-huh.
Got on a bus and rode to Salem, Virginia with my backpack, a roll, and had my Japanese sword in there that the admiral was giving all the staff officers. They had gone and collected after the war. They collected all of them, there was a big box. And I went in, I wasn't afraid. I went in and talked to him. I said, "Hey, I understand you're giving swords away to the staff." He said, "Yeah," and he spoke. He said, "Take him in there, let him get his sword." I went in and opened up this box, and there was hundreds and a huge box. But they're all blue and gold. I said, "I don't want a Navy sword. I want an Army one." So I dug down deep and got an Army one. I mean, the Army's Japanese sword. And so I brought that home. And I walked up the hill. It was snowing. And I went into my stepmother's house and I said, "Hey, I'm home. Oh, we're glad to see you back." That was my return.
Welcome,
you know?
Yeah.
You know, it was... No flags, nothing. I didn't mind. That was nice. I was home.
Yeah.
But you can see that I had wonderful duty.
Mm-hmm.
I had good jobs. I had exciting jobs. And I had, I think, responsible jobs, and I did well.
Right.
I was promoted when I was on Ebi Island with the Navy. Orders came through for all that group, so I was on Palilu with. We all got promoted, and I became a major.
Uh-huh.
So I had pretty good retirement by that time, you know. So I went to Duke, and I was in school for about 3 or 4 months, and finally my terminal leave, you know, passed out. So I was in school when that happened.
Okay.
And another thing that I've done all my life. In high school, I took voice lessons. And I was singing at a Presbyterian church. And so I was giving solos in a big church there in Roanoke, Virginia. And at Virginia Tech, I was a member of a quartet for 4 years.
Wow.
And I became president of the glee club we formed. And at the Apple Blossom Festival, the cadets were, the Glee Club were princes, escorts for the princesses. And I sang a solo, and I got a newspaper article said there were 60,000 people there.
Wow.
And it was just a short piece that that we sang. But so then I went to New York to visit my son before I went to school after getting out of the Army. And my brother-in-law was getting his master's at Juilliard School of Music. So they he took me to his voice class, and they evaluated my voice, and they said, you are a Shinto tenor, a heavy tenor, just like Caruso. Well, when I came to Gainesville, I started singing in a choir, but I didn't know how to sing, you know. I'd never been trained with this voice that I had found.
Right.
And so finally, when I was about 60 years old, a fellow came from New York, and he had taught voice up there, so his daughter was in Gainesville here. And so I took lessons for him for about a year, and he taught me some Caruso song, including this aria here, and I've been trying to learn to sing it. And this one here, and it's a beautiful piece of music. And but I was having trouble learning to pronounce the Italian words. So I went to this lady here that lives here. She's was born in Rome, and she said, you will never learn to pronounce those words correctly. So I'm giving up on that. I might have to sing something else.
Cats, that would be good.
But memory or something like that.
Yeah.
But I sang the last talent show a month ago, and I sang Old Man River. There's an old man on the Mississippi, and so forth.
Oh, Paul Robeson. Paul Robeson, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, so I've always had a commanding voice, and
yeah,
I did well as a field commander, adjutant. And but I'm very proud of my my service, and those were, I think, my ratings at the time I was promoted to major.
All right.
I think that's what that is.
Superior, excellent.
Yeah.
Superior, excellent. Yes. And these are the different McQuaid's, California, CAGS School, excellent, Fort Monroe. Telecom Peleliu, superior. This is when you were assistant.
Yeah.
G3. Peleliu, 1st January 1945. Oh, I see. 19 April 44 to 1st January 45, you had a rating of superior. And then the next area, you were assistant J3. And this is
G3 or something.
Yeah, this is Commar.
Writing letters.
Okay. May, let's see, April 45 to May 45. Excellent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, this is real high ranks. High, excellent, superior.
Keep turning and you'll find those pictures of the rest camp. Oh, you can't read that. That's not very good.
Okay, these are...
There are a lot of orders.
Ratings.
Yeah, just go on.
Marshall Gilbert's area.
Yeah, that's where I was trying to find those areas.
You actually flew in the bay, the torpedo bay? Well, when you were flying the torpedo bay, were you upside down?
Oh, no. I was looking through the cracks.
Oh, okay. So you were like on your...
Oh, yeah. I was sitting in there and...
Okay.
I was brown as could be. And that's the only tree on that island.
Uh-huh. Now, you said, Dr. Huffman, that you... that the U.S. used napalm at Peleliu.
Yeah.
Do you remember smelling it?
I don't know. No, I don't think so. Because we use a lot of oil and what do you call the bug medicine, you know, that's now been outlawed.
DDT.
DDT, yeah.
Yeah.
You go to a head, you know, to go to the bathroom, boy, it was nothing but oil and that stuff.
Yeah.
And it was very prominent, you know, the oil and...
So you couldn't really smell much of anything else.
That's the nice thing about a computer, and take a small photograph and blow yourself up.
Yeah, you're right behind a commanding officer.
Yeah, just right behind the men. And I never met him, actually.
Oh, really?
No, I never met him.
Uh-huh.
Now, you're coming to the place where we're staying. Now, the next picture you're going to see is that girl. Yeah, now there she is right in front on the left.
Oh, right here. She's the nurse. Red Cross nurse, you said?
Yeah, the one that has her hand down in front.
Okay.
Not the white nurse.
But she was from... Let's see,
New York.
It says, I was too busy, and besides, she was a Yankee.
Yeah.
Did you ever keep in contact with her in later years?
Oh, no.
Okay.
After that one date, we never contacted each other because I was so involved. And,
uh-huh.
And
when you were in the service, Dr. Hoffman, did you ever... when you kind of knew that the war, I mean, was there a point in which you knew that it became common knowledge that the U.S. was going to win the war?
Was going to win it?
Yeah, was going to win it.
No, I don't think so. But the way we were advancing, you know, in the Pacific, we would get weekly reports, and it just looked like everything we got was touched was going well. We knew we were getting lots of casualties,
mm-hmm.
you know, and now we knew that spring our instructor at Virginia Tech says, gentlemen, war's coming, so prepare yourself. So it was no surprise to us to have, of course it was a surprise to how it started, you know, Pearl Harbor.
Right.
But we were all prepared to go into the Army,
uh-huh.
Well prepared. And the ROTC people, I think, was a good program, you know, that they mm-hmm. trained a lot of officers. And so I'm all in favor of that, of having a civilian, that was a civilian army, you know.
Yeah.
And
But were you still, where were you when you heard about Pearl Harbor?
I was at Fort Eustis.
You're at Fort Eustis.
Yeah.
How did you react to the news?
Very calmly.
Uh-huh.
Just go back the next day with a little bit more purpose in your, you know, in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
And that was about the time I had stood up 1,000 men in a theater. That's when I thought I was going to get shot.
Uh-huh. But you imagined up to that point that you were probably going, or at a later point, though, when you thought about going overseas, you thought that you were going to Europe.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did most of the people that you served with end up going to Europe instead of?
I think most of them went to Europe.
Okay.
Most of them went to Europe. A lot of my friends were killed in Virginia Tech. Not a lot of them, but
uh-huh.
I know quite a few friends were killed.
What was the difference between serving in the Pacific Theater and versus Europe?
Well, we always had warm weather, you know.
Uh-huh.
And it was always pleasant. And we went through a few hurricanes, typhoons. And I remember one day we were on Castle Pashvich. We were waiting to go south down to Peleliu,
mm-hmm.
and a passage in a harbor, and the hurricane struck. And and we were tied up, and but one evening, a squadron of PT boats came along, and one came right close to the stern where we were leaning over the rail watching, you know. And here this officer was having his hand on a rope or a lanyard, you know, tied to the bow, and he was just in his shorts and his cap and his shoes, you know, pouring down rain, and the TP boat going like that over these different waves. But each one of them tied up behind a ship in the lee side, you know.
Okay.
And so we're able to go ashore, you know, to get a little bit of rest.
Uh-huh.
And, but that was a sort of a thrilling thing to see that squadron pass through us. And, and some of those other days it would be quite rainy, and I would just have shoes and shorts and foul weather gear, Navy gear.
Yeah.
And And so it could be raining and blowing wind. And actually, there were three of us in that tent. Mm-hmm. Two are Navy and me, two were Navy officers. And we each had a cot, you know, and plenty of room, and had a round table in there. The commander who outranked me, he was a Navy guy, he says, you know, here we sit right next to our dining hall. We got a shower. We can take a shower every day. They wouldn't believe how comfortable we are living, you know. But then a week earlier, I almost stepped on a landmine.
Right.
You know.
Did you ever have the opportunity to go and visit Japan?
No, nor Philippines.
Okay.
I was working all the time, and we had no chance to get leave when we were over, mm-hmm. over there. I think maybe, well, after the war, probably lots of people went to Japan, you know, on leave or something mm-hmm. like that.
Right.
But
did you hear about some of the atrocities that took place, or you would still have been maybe stateside when those things occurred, like say the Bataan Death March or
oh yeah
okay
yeah that had already happened
yeah
and but you know we had. When I was working in that big, on Peleliu, working on those plans, you know, for the defense of the islands, I did a lot of paperwork right there, and I was looking at Blood and Nose Ridge right through my window here. Uh-huh. And one day they were fixing the roads out there, and a big rock comes flying through them. But every morning, the MPs would come through, and they had about four or five Japanese. And they were in little brown khaki uniforms with their hats on, and not steel helmets, but their little soft hats. And they were sweeping up and cleaning up, mm-hmm. you know, the place. And probably these were just workers, you know, they were probably not soldiers.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of civilian Japanese, I'm sure, around. And. Hey, and I've written a lot about my family, and I say the greatest accomplishment in my life was to marry this girl. She died 2 years ago.
Oh, wow.
And there's a little memorial over there for her.
Uh-huh.
We travel a lot, and that one picture of her, she's up at Acapulco.
Okay.
In that parasail.
Oh, wow. Okay.
She just loved it. She was 60 years old.
Uh-huh. She
just loved it.
Beautiful woman. How long were you married?
What? 60 years.
60 years. Wow. Yeah.
And she was just a lovely girl and so well-liked by everybody and smart as a tack. She was a lot. She just had a high school education.
Uh-huh.
But she was a lot smarter than I was.
So you just married a few years after the war. Right? 19...
It was after the war.
Yeah, maybe 1948?
Yeah, 48, because I got a job in a plywood mill my first job was at a plywood mill.
Okay.
At Brunswick, Georgia, and that's where she was raised. And her father helped build 99 Liberty ships there in Brunswick.
Wow.
And she was in the payroll department. She'd just gotten out of high school. And she was on a payroll department, and they paid 25,000 workers once a week in cash.
Wow.
And she had to count the nickels and ladies. That was one of her jobs.
Yeah.
But she was always a numbers person. She worked for attorneys accountants or credit unions.
Uh-huh.
She never worked when the kids were at home.
Okay.
She always worked when they were in school.
In school, okay.
And she got jobs, part-time jobs, just when they were in school.
Uh-huh.
So our kids were never without a mother, you know, at home.
Right.
And we had two boys.
What kind of impact did the GI Bill of Rights have?
It was just Splendid. I got all my education. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, Virginia Tech. My father died when I was 16. Mm-hmm. My mother died when I was seven, actually. And but my father married a school teacher who had been a missionary in China. So she was well-educated, but a school teacher. And so after my father died in high school, my stepmother continued to be my guardian, you know. Mm-hmm. And but my dad only left me only $2,000 insurance. And that put me through college. But I had to work.
Yeah.
I worked 3 years, mm-hmm. waiting tables. And and I used to go hunting with my dad, you know, so I love my dad because we lived on the farm, you know, my uncle lived on the farm and we'd go back to the farm periodically. And
now you showed me pictures, Dr. Huffman, of your ancestors in the Confederate War. Did your elders talk much about the Civil War when you were growing up?
Well, I was only 3 years old when they were, so I never talked much about them. Now I still am a member of the Newcastle Historical Society, the county seat is Newcastle, Virginia, 19 miles from where I was born.
Okay.
And so I'm a member of that historic society. And I sent them lots of stuff that have happened to my family.
Okay.
I've written the history of my family, my mother and father and sisters. And mm-hmm. He was an educator and and also was an ordained minister. But he'd bury and marry people, you know.
Yeah.
And but he was a wonderful speaker and had a good voice, you know, and spoke well. But I was a poor student. I had to work like the devil to get good grades. And one time when I was in junior high, he said, "Jake, would you like to go back and live on the farm?" Now those farms were just going down, you know, the small farms. I wasn't interested. That put a bug under my tail, I guess. But he never knew how well I did in college, you know.
Uh-huh.
But I had to study like the devil to get good grades.
Yeah.
And I only felt comfortable when I went back to Duke and I was taking a minor in engineering with young people and I was been in the Army for 5 years, you know.
Right.
And I got A's and it was easy.
Okay.
Now I'd learned how to study, I guess, or something, or maybe.
Discipline and.
Just, and I had to learn a foreign language. I had to learn French and German.
Uh-huh.
And that was an ordeal. You had to pass a test, you know.
Right.
And so I was tutored in both of those subjects at Duke University. So I could pass the.
And that's where you did your doctorate?
Master's and doctorate.
Master's and doctorate, okay.
Yeah, I got my master's right after the plywood plant. And I went to and taught a year at West Virginia University and liked it.
Okay.
And my wife, we were married and we'd been in a plywood mill and I taught that year at West Virginia. And so, and she was very active with the Wives Club at Duke University. And so I had, I played more golf at Duke and we would have labs and and I would go through them fast and do the work and get ahead so I could take off the rest of the afternoon. So I had my major professor play golf, so we'd go play golf, you know. And so that was a lot of fun. But I learned to play golf when I was 11 years old. My dad was head of a summer resort. He was part owner and manager, and he built the 9-hole golf course. I went and caddied when I was 11 and 12, and the pro taught me how to hit a golf.
Okay.
So, I had a great duty.
Yeah.
All my life. And
Yeah, I was at Duke in graduate school from 93 to 2000. And that's where I took my history PhD in 2000.
At Duke?
At Duke.
Mm-hmm. The history professor there at Duke was once in my platoon.
Oh, really? Okay.
And about 3 years, somewhere along the line, he was on that deal tell when I took it down by the James River, you know, and gave them the speech. I gave that battalion my speech. But he said I was a very well-respected officer. I remember one day we were out marching, and in the cold weather, it was cold and bitter cold. Everybody was bundled up, and I was at my platoon out there practicing, you know. And I spotted one man who didn't have any gloves. So I stopped the platoon. I said, "Soldier, where are your gloves?" "Sir, I lost them." I said, "Well, take mine." So I took off my gloves and gave them. Now, that made an impression on the soldiers. I mean, little things like that.
Yeah.
And when we were standing there waiting to shoot a gun, you know, we have rest periods. Well, I'd be out there and play touch football with them, you know. And so I remember I was leading the charge. Somebody was running with the ball, and I was sort of reading, and I bumped into this guy from the country, never played touch football, and I hit him with my shoulder and knocked him one. I sort of felt sorry for him, you know, that I hit him so hard. He wasn't used to that, you know. But there were a number of things that when I talked to my battalion, they gave me a standing ovation. I couldn't shut them up. You have a whole battalion, that my platoon was sitting over there. And when I got up on the stage, you know, giving my talk, well, they wouldn't sit down.
And that was the speech, the Why We Fight speech?
Why We Fight, yes.
Okay.
It was a series of lectures, and that was the number 15. It was the last one.
Okay. So was that a lecture that you wrote, or that?
No,
was,
no.
Okay.
They gave me a stack of stuff like that, and I sweated blood, you know, at night, trying to prepare, because I'd never given a speech before, and here was wasn't 1,000 men, 800 men, maybe it filled a theater, you know.
Yeah.
And I sweated blood, but once I got it down, it was no problem. And but I just talked to them like I was really their father, you know, and tell them to get out there and do, whether they're peeling potatoes or carrying a gun or whatever they were doing, do the good job.
Yeah.
Now there were two, and one of the officers said, "Jake, you sounded like a preacher when you were talking to them." Well, this was their last, they were leaving the next day or so, you know. So maybe they needed something like that, encouragement.
Yeah.
Anyway, this guy, 3 years later, we were all officers. He had become an officer. And he said, "Captain," or whatever I was in your platoon at Fort Eustis. And boy, you were respected. You know, they really thought a lot of you, which was nice. And he turned up being a history professor at Duke University.
Wow.
I met him later. Uh-huh. Years later.
What was his name? Do you remember?
Oh, I have no idea.
But he was a history professor there in the 40s. And
yeah, I have no idea. I've forgotten.
Uh-huh.
Hey, my wife, when she was in Haven Hospice, she wrote a letter. No, she told my son. She says, "If I die tomorrow, I have lived my life to the fullest, and I have no regrets. Mm-hmm. I've lived my life beyond my fondest dreams." Now, isn't that nice of something? He was getting ready to die?
Yeah, it is.
I feel the same way, I think.
Yeah.
But, and I have her picture and that statement underneath it. Now, that's what a friend wrote about Dot.
Okay.
Pansy Post, and it's such a nice letter. It ought to be published because it's just an outstanding letter about friendship.
Mm-hmm.
And Dot was a wonderful person. I say she was a lot smarter than I was.
When did you meet her?
I met her in Brunswick, Georgia.
Okay.
And she was a clerk, and there were four of us employed. We had our master's degree. We were quality control people. It's brand big plywood mill. And my job was to collect samples, among other things, was to collect samples from every few hours and coming into the lab, which was right next door. And I would go and saw them up and then put them on this machine and break them and see that they met the standard, you know. But I would see a lot of her because I was going in and out like this. And one day I asked her for a date, and she was a wonderful dancer. She loved the boys, you know, what's the Fort Benning or something, George, that Fort Stewart.
Fort Stewart?
Yeah. The boys would come down to Brunswick for the weekend. And,
oh, okay.
And she would date them. She said she dated every night, and they'd go dancing, you know. She dated enlisted men and officers, but she was a wonderful dancer. And so I took over, of course, when I found out she was still dating a fellow from Georgia Tech, and she had a thing on the front of her car, Georgia Tech, you know, for a boyfriend. But I had him every week, every day, and he had him only on the weekends, you know. But finally, we got along real well. And I said, it's my greatest act was to marry that girl. But,
wow, 60 years. Mm-hmm. When you got back stateside, Dr. Huffman, and when you you processed out through Fort Bragg.
Yes.
What did you notice changes in American society, say before the war and after? Did, in your mind, did the war change the country, or did it just kind of seem to be status quo?
Well, of course, I was a student before and after, so your life was pretty controlled by your classes and I know that big thing you noticed was the cost of the items.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just in high school, I was putting in 25 cents worth of gas in my car, my dad's car that he had bought, you know, a Rio Flying Cloud, one of these big old heavy cars, you know. And that's what I learned to drive. And I'd get it on weekends. My sister would use it during the week. And so my brother and I would push it down to the filling station a block away and put in a quarter's worth of gas and take it to the movie, you know, downtown.
Uh-huh.
And but every night, even when my dad was alive, I would drive it around and park it in the down the alley and had to back up to get in the garage every night. But, and I say prices were real low cost, and I worked in a grocery store. And I was taking music lessons, so I worked for a butcher, so I was a singing butcher. and when we got back, the cars were hard to get, find, you know. I bought a secondhand one, and prices had gone up. But there again, you were in school, and I guess I had plenty of money, you know, being a major. I wasn't taxed for pocket change.
Yeah.
But I was very frugal, you know, and I saved my money. And I raised two sons. My son, I think, paid $800 for this 5 or 6 years ago.
Oh, the organ.
But, and they both, my older son took drums and my younger son played the guitar, and he's still playing his guitar.
Uh-huh.
He worked for the St. Pete Times, and So he members of the new college and members of his newspaper, and they all played. So they finally got enough money to buy their own equipment, and he still plays for Jigs.
Wow.
And he has a $1 million job. He works for a money show company.
Okay.
And he's been to China twice, and he's been to Europe on business.
Uh-huh.
And so he's well off. And my other son sells slumber, and he's well off also.
Uh-huh.
But we raised two excellent boys. They are both in college, and one of them has graduated, engineer. And I'm still trying to sing. I don't know, might find some of these pictures interesting. It's there I am in a captain's uniform. I still have my, this is our train trip from Fort Eustis to California. And the train wrecked, had this sprockets fell off as we were entering a tunnel. And so we were tied up there for 6 hours.
Wow.
And I was I worked with the mess sergeant. I had the money. They gave me $800 to buy fresh food on the way. So I was an agent aide on the troop shipment. And I was the only one got off the plane that day, off the train.
Mm-hmm.
And I had my camera. And this is Camp McQuaid. This was my little hut. It had a little stove in it. And we'd walk across the drill field some mornings, and the fog would come in, and it'd be layered. And you could see your feet, but you couldn't see a head coming at your way. It was so thick.
So thick, wow.
It'd just come in like that and cover you up.
Uh-huh.
And we could hear the surf at night just from those tents. And we went horseback riding up in the redwoods. And here I am at Commander General Staff School. That's the house. This is an old established fort. This was one of these fellows was from Britain. And all the officers were in that house there. It was a big residence, 10 weeks. And training to be staff officers. Oh, here I drew a picture.
Oh, that was in a...
That was driving like I was in a airship. And I also drew the short snorters club. And he initiated you when you went across the international date line. And there's my discharge paper, some of them. That's Bloody Nose Ridge, where all that fighting was going on. Uh-huh. That's where all the Marines were killed. And this is that building. No, that's see what this is. Oh, that's my uncle who was killed. Yeah, I'll show you some of these. And if you have a question, you can ask.
Okay.
Now, this was when I was Fort Eustis. We actually had old helmets. This is 1941. I was a second lieutenant. This was our hike down by the James River, and we found Civil War trenches.
Oh, wow.
And that's what we were playing with, and that's when I was supposed to be giving a talk that morning. And here's on the rifle range. I don't know what's on the other side. Oh, there's nothing there. Now here's another set of pictures. These are field. This is a camouflage area. When I went to camouflage school, I came back to Cape McQuaid, and There's this big sand dune right on the bluff there. But there's a machine gun nest. If you put the garlands in that screen, you can fold that back, you know, and protect it from above. And then this, I got it. My first flight was in this little plane here, this Navy plane, and we came low at low altitude. And in this picture, you could see individuals. They were looking up, you know. And then later on, I went and I got flights in this blimp. And the morning I went over to, they were going to let me go up for an hour and go up. But the second blimp had wrecked.
Ooh.
So we waited around and finally took off about 7 o'clock. And we went out about 25 miles and went all the way up to San Francisco, turned around and came back. So I had an all-day trip with them. Mm-hmm. Because they had to take that duty from that other ship was supposed to take. Mm-hmm. And so by that time, this other officer went on. He was a major. He outranked me, so he got to go along. And here I am inside. It's sort of like a street car, you know, and with cabinets on the side. But we were driving the thing by this time. It's a big wheel this way and a big wheel this, look like a bicycle wheel.
Okay.
And easy, but by the time we got ready to come in over Pebble Beach Golf Club, the captain got it back in control. And he said, watch me knock off those seals off that rock there. And there were thousands of seals on that rock. We buzzed them and boy, they scattered. That was that they wouldn't allow that day.
Right.
But, and then we went on land but I had several good rides in that blimp. And then I went up in the AT-6
mm-hmm.
and I was in the front seat and the pilot was in the back. And that's when I did a lot of acrobatic. Hey, here are my guns. I'm still an amateur, I guess. I didn't do a good job of policing the area around it. The guns were hidden, but not very good. And then here's a close-up of that.
The building and then...
That building. And eventually the island commander's tent was here, and my tent was on the other side. So that's what you see here. You saw that picture there.
Oh, yeah.
On both sides of it. And but they fixed that up real. And my office was over a sauna bath, a tile bath, Japanese bath, and the bathroom was back here. And there were little squat seats on at floor level. But we never didn't use it, you know. We had an outhouse somewhere. but that was real close to the Bloody Nose Ridge, you know. And the first night I was sleeping right here behind that, and the bullets were coming down mm-hmm. from that hill. And I came over here and got parts of a plane, Zero. These planes that were all over the field. Oh, here's that picture. So here's that building. And here's the fellow that with that head holding up that axe.
Oh, yeah.
Somewhere.
Wow.
That I'd found. Now, I got off at 4 o'clock that day, or mm-hmm. maybe at noon, and I built this little Christmas tree. And what we call the reefer, the cans of beer are right across the street, about from here to that door there.
Uh-huh.
And just across the street here. And so all these officers had to come and get their beer at 5 o'clock. And so a couple of us started singing Christmas carols in there. And I bet my tent was full of officers singing Christmas carols for about 2 hours.
Wow.
That was Christmas Day.
Christmas Day, yeah.
So that was real nice. Here I am. That was my normal outfit in good weather.
Yeah. Wow. Well, thanks for sharing all this amazing information with me, Dr. Hoffman. I really appreciate it. Hallelujah.
Hallelujah. Here's the... So here's the Babelthorpe of Palau Islands. So there were a lot of Japanese, and they came down that night, down both sides. I have this picture with the... showing the track of those two barges as they came down. And also, when I was on this ship going back and forth unloading, the planes would take off and they were bombing Japanese, and the Japanese were going from this island to this.
Uh-huh.
And somebody turned on the speaker from the pilots. So we heard them say, hey, we hit that. The pilot would yell, hey, I hit that thing. That barge turned over like a big fat elephant, you know, like this. And they were talking about the Japanese that they were trying to catch. So it was very, very close to the battle, but we were not in it, you know.
Yeah.
Which is, yeah, I did not take that picture, but I saw that time and time again.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, here's the, I don't know. So I was giving this talk, so you can see this is the way that the Marines took the island.
Yeah.
They landed here, and that was Bloody Nose Ridge here. I have some books about that, about a soldier that is a great author, but he was in the front lines, and he was right in this this hurt 30 days. That's all he wrote about, just the 30 days he was on the island.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, that they had it rough. So this was my domestic flights across the country.
Okay. Eustace Monroe.
And camouflage school at Fort Belvoir near Fredericksburg.
Well, you had an active career.
Mm-hmm. Now, most of my black and white pictures are in those two boxes right below me, right here.
Uh-huh.
They're just packed full. And every one of them is dated and numbered.
Mm-hmm.
And so I do have a lot of pictures. Most of those were after the...
Uh-huh. Have you talked to Special Collections at UF about maybe donating those pictures, those photographs?
Well, now, you know, that's a question that it's going to be a problem. Armand from the Victory Motel, Victory Museum in Yulee. Nice little town. The little railroad town has a museum.
Oh.
The Victory Museum?
Right. What is that town? Dang it.
Right outside of Gainesville.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Not,
I'll keep saying Yulee, and it's not Yulee.
No, but they have the, yeah, I know exactly, yeah. So, but you've talked to him?
He wants it.
Okay.
He wants everything I got.
Uh-huh.
And I said, I don't know. I might give you certain things, you know.
Uh-huh.
But I want to talk to you and ask you, is there anything that you are particularly interested in? Who should get the original
mm-hmm.
orders that I got? The original order. Now, I could send them to New Orleans.
To the World War II Museum. Well, I think... your story is a really compelling story. And now we have, you know, I have the oral history interview. You have all these great photographs. You have a detailed record.
Yeah.
And I think it should go to some place that is going to use that material.
I'm afraid of the Victor Museum. It's privately owned.
Uh-huh.
I would rather give it to the university.
Okay.
But I like to give him something.
Yeah.
Now, I have my uniform and my hat, my blouse. I don't have my trousers.
Okay. Maybe that would be something to give to the Victory Museum.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're more into having exhibits, maybe, and
yeah.
people can see.
But you're more interested in the information.
Well,
written information.
Yeah, I mean, from the perspective of the oral history program, we're very interested in, you know, certainly photographs, logbooks, diaries. The way you've organized your information is very efficient. And now I cannot speak for the library, though, but I would certainly endorse the idea of having your, you know, your photographs and the paper material. My sense would be it should go to the UF library, because a researcher in the future will be able to listen to the tape, hear you talk about the places that you served at, look at your orders, look at some of the photographs. And it seems logical that it would, that that material would go to UF. The only however is that I don't run the library.
Yeah.
I run the oral history program.
Yeah.
I certainly would endorse the idea of having, you know, if you want your materials to go to the library, then I would certainly talk, you know, I would personally be happy to talk.
If you get stuff, do you turn it over to the library?
We do. And sometimes, though, they tell us that, well, they have a practice where they kind of decide whether they're going to take materials. Now, the other challenge is, they'll take materials, but sometimes it'll take them a while to process them. In other words, you can donate materials, but they may not be used for a while until they can get them accessed. But my guess would be to say, if we called over there in concert, judge what they have to say, and then you decide whether or not you want to deposit. Yeah. And just see how they respond. Mm-hmm. We could have Jim Cusick. I could ask Jim or Carl Van Ness, maybe if they'd be willing to come out here and take a look at your materials. I know one of the things that they will say is that when they get papers now.
Carl Van Ness.
Carl Van Ness.
Yeah, I know him.
Okay. One of the things they say now is they're more likely to take material and process it if some money comes with it.
Yeah.
You know the deal.
Yeah.
So that's one that's one consideration to think about. I worry about New Orleans, just simply because
it'd be buried.
Well, it could be buried. I mean, they could use it, but the problem is we've taken huge budget cuts here. They've taken just terrible cuts there, from what I understand. And so I don't know how long it's going to take them to recover. I don't know. We certainly work in alliance with them.
Yeah.
But I have just heard nothing but really grim news from New Orleans. I'll actually go ahead and say.
Yeah.
Was there anything else you wanted to add, Dr. Huffman, about World War II or your...
I don't think I need to say anything more. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to the oral history group, and I hope that I can donate some of this stuff for your records, and you can do what is you think is best for them. What I have here is writing and rewriting and rewriting. Mm-hmm. So you see different notebooks.
Right.
It's the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, I'm getting it typed. But the typing without the pictures is very cold.
Yeah.
You know? And so if you have the written or the typed scenario, and then a supply of pictures, I think would be great.
Yeah.